What is a protest song?
what is a protest song?
Subversive voice.
Hello, I'm Oscar Cox Jensen, and joining me today is Sam Lee. Sam, I'm going to describe you as a force of nature as well as a force for nature. Sam sings, writes, and collects songs of all kinds, drawing especial inspiration in the past from his experience among the UK traveller community. He is the author of The Nightingale and a familiar presence on radio and television. Sam is also an organiser and activist on many issues, chiefly focused on the climate, habitat loss, and nature. In short, he has fingers in so many pies, he's probably had to start using his toes. Sam, hello.
Hey, Oscar. Thanks for that introduction.
Sam, this finds you pretty much fresh back from COP27, is that right?
Indeed, yeah. I'm sort of in that depressive, but yeah, jet lag. Climate lag, but I was only there for 6 days, but it was an extraordinary experience to be part of and witness the chaos and disorder and inequality and madness and privilege and all the paradoxes that it is. The actual conference itself, I had a Blue Zone pass for the first time this year, so I got to kind of sneak around and listen into things that I wouldn't usually have heard, and the culture was certainly in there too.
Were you there to facilitate things, to make conversations happen, or were you there as part of a more demonstrative role? What did you get up to?
Well, it's kind of hard to say. You're just there. Sometimes the conversations that you have one-to-one are as important as the getting up and singing and the small platforms that one has there and the opportunities. It's about exchange and also as much about making the effort to make sure that culture is incorporated and more present, but also within that platform that's made about the voices that can then be amplified that don't usually get as privileged an access within the conference. There's as many different experiences and takeaways of COP as there are people there, and it's the biggest conference in the world. You know, there's 30,000 delegates, let alone all the other people who are there in subsidiary roles and high level roles, but not official, let's say. Coverage is always very difficult because I think the newspapers are wanting to come out with the tangible negotiation sort of outtakes and draftings of treaties and that sort of thing, of which there's been some good stuff that's come out this year. The loss and damage has made progress. The failure on 1.5, which is kind of the absurd thing, it sort of mirrors for me the World Cup situation, that we're happy just to accept the fact that it's really fucked up and the massive amounts of inequality. But in the end, it'll be fine because we'll just have fun and play lots of sport and swallow the consequences and our moral obligations. And I think that seems to be what happens at COP, which is just we'll set aside lots of money to support those people who die, but we'll just carry on as is and let's not rock the boat too much. And that seems to me the sort of great madness of it. I think what there is hope for is that whatever the future is we inherit, there's going to be a coming together. And I think COP is a practice of this. Of diverse, extraordinary female-led, indigenous-led wisdom. And what perseveres ecologically, humanity-wise, society-wise, we don't know, but COP is a great place for an exchange of visions and ideas of what responsibility is, and also developing the sort of global communities that are going to be needed in the future, particularly the youth-led ones, that where the youth were so strong in their voices this year. In fact, it was written into some of the COP, what shall I say, protocols, that there needs to be youth voice involved. And that feels very important. I think the places that inspire me the most, we had speeches made by they were there in force, the two indigenous senators that have been voted into Brazilian government. One of the Culture COP events we had, they came in and did a speech on the stage at the Sharm-el-Sheikh Museum with the Greek statue behind us. And it was this amazing kind of meeting of cultures and worlds. And they get up on stage and the first thing they do is start singing an Amazonian traditional chant before going into speech. And it's just so wonderful hearing that cultural power, that identity, and how song is and prayer thus are part of leadership. how that's so missing from the bureaucracy and the discourse that you get elsewhere that is so devoid of any like connection to identity and the people that each leading delegate is there representing. It feels like everyone's there representing corporation more than they are of, yeah, human beings.
Book The Nightingale, you quote Caroline Lucas, the Green MP, as saying, we need you to paint the positive picture of how the world can be. And you use this to talk about the role of the arts, music, of the idea of generating that kind of chorus of voices from people all over the world. Do you think this needs to be a more audible element of this kind of thing? And could you expand on what you meant in that quotation?
Well, it's funny hearing you say it. And at first, I misunderstood that, of the position of who she was talking to.
Yeah, who is the you? That's the good point.
Who is the you? In this instance, I was like, well, she's talking to other politicians, isn't she? And it's like, oh no, of course they're not the ones with the imagination to vision the future. That's not why they got in it. And that's not what they're judged upon to become politicians. Though ultimately, COP is a place where that demand from Caroline Lucas, as she's doing brilliantly right now, is there to challenge the voices of politicians of whose interests they're speaking on behalf of. But I also think that, you know, there she's speaking specifically, and maybe I've co-opted that comment as an invitation to the general public in some respects, because it is about us all being artists, us all being creative and imaginative thinkers, to kind of vision what better would look like. But particularly those in position of authority or power, creative or non-creative, about how we can see the solutions in imaginative thinking. And we witnessed in other examples of where better is, to call out to everyone, really. We live in such a time of disempowerment. Everyone is so subject to the terms and conditions of the economic state, the government, the laws. How can we behave in a way that actually sometimes incorporates what the alternative could look like to exist and behave as if it already had changed? And that's something I believe in immensely. I think the beautiful thing about being a musician is that we are offered one of the most powerful positions to engage and move people. Ultimately, it's about moving people in the ears straight through to the heart. So we're working with a very powerful but sensitive and often corrupted art form, which can win out over all the other tools of disengagement, be that social media, be that just general apathy or the exhaustions of society. Music is one of those things that just captivates and can really hold people into a place of, like, you know, manipulate people into a place of positive re-engagement.
I like your use of the term manipulation there.
Manipulation in all, you know, in all its negative and all its positive qualities is about calling in people to acknowledge things that they wouldn't necessarily have thought about, be that a reflection of their own self or the world around them. Manipulation is such a negative word, really, but actually it's about the power to inspire and reignite people in a place of awareness, and where we can't travel and we can't maybe do the things and have the extraordinary lives of connection to different cultures, music can serve that place of storytelling and wonderment that makes people feel beholden to a subject, an idea. I mean, I speak about this in relationship to nature and how music can, in combination, in sync, you know, it's as a soundtrack to a concept or an experience, can create such a powerful allegiance. You know, words like re-enchant are very regularly used in my vocabulary, because we live in a time of such disenchantment where we feel so co-opted, that music in correspondence with visions of better can manipulate is the word, but in a very benevolent way.
Benevolent manipulation, I will sign up to that. And re-enchantment is great, and you touch on nature. In your very wonderful and wide-ranging book on the nightingale, you speak of that bird as a symbol of resistance. And if people don't know, they should check this out. I think still annually, you will go on these what you call bird pilgrimages and seek out the nightingale and sort of try and construct a genuine two-way conversation in a way that nearly a century ago the BBC set up some entirely false ones, but getting people out there into the woods and
not entirely false, actually. There was a bit of misrepresentation of whether it was real or not.
Okay, just a slight sleight of hand. You also speak of those things as a protest in themselves. Could you talk a little more about your ornithological side and how you feel that does connect to these wider issues of habitat loss, climate change, political resistance?
I see the nightingale as, for me, my sort of symbol of resistance, in that they are the canary in the mine, an ancient bird that's been connected to human culture for thousands of years, no doubt has been an inspiration to early hominids to understand the rudiments of language and song when they were one and the same, and have accompanied humans in our extraordinary journey. And over those thousands of years that we have had the joy of listening to them, we find ourselves now in a time where possibly within my lifetime I'll hear the last nightingale sing, certainly in the UK, if not globally. That is a bird that is so entwined with an ecosystem that is immensely fragile right now and vulnerable, and the consequences are so enormous. The bird is a call for us all to pay attention and to listen deeply and remember and live in the present, honour the past, and contemplate what a future might be devoid of a bird like the nightingale. So the pilgrimages are their experiences with musicians to go and play music with the birds, because they respond back with human-made music, but also go into a place of ceremony, as I call it now, a sort of palliative care in this time of celebration and also saying farewell and acceptance of what we have to lose.
People listening might think this is quite a rural or sylvan experience that you're discussing here as well. But 3 years ago in 2019, you brought some of this into the city, right? I believe on the 29th of April as part of the XR demonstrations. Many nightingales sang in Berkeley Square.
They did. It was the closing ceremony of the spring uprising, of the beginning of Extinction Rebellion's kind of mass explosion into the world. We led about 1,500 people in the square, calling them to stream the nightingale song that we had on our web, you know, available off their phone. So everybody was playing nightingales in Berkeley Square. So we rewilded the nightingale back to Berkeley Square, its kind of pop music spiritual home. Yeah, and had musicians and poets and artists kind of rhapsodizing alongside, and we had speeches and ceremonies. A very special day. Yeah, we got 2.5 minutes of birdsong into number 18 in the charts, which is no mean feat. An incredible opportunity to work with the RSPB to bring artistic endeavour into the mainstream, and how we could, every radio station had to play, you know, the top 20. So they had to do 2.5 minutes of birdsong, and I think it was greatly appreciated.
On that night in Berkeley Square, you sang a parody or rewriting of the early 20th century song A Nightingale Sang at Berkeley Square. Can you remember any of that or any of the lyrical changes you made? Because I'm very interested in updating of songs.
Oh, yeah. Well, we did sing the song. Obviously, we had to, but it was, I had to co-opt it to be more appropriate. A certain night, the night we met, there was magic abroad in the air. There were angels marching in the street and the nightingale sang at Berkeley Square. Stronger, yeah, like never before, we hope like we never had dared, that we might turn this world around and have nightingales sing in Berkeley Square.
I may be wrong, but I'm perfectly willing to swear.
It's a beautiful thing. That was one of the great days of my life, actually, doing that.
Wonderful. And getting the angels to march in the street seems a very powerful statement. Speaking of marching, you've also been involved quite a lot over the years, but especially this summer in the Right to Roam movement, where there was at least some coverage of the sort of semi-occupation of Richard Bennion's estate. Is that right? But from the pictures, it looked like a far more, looked like great fun as much as anything else.
I mean, it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about behaving as if the change had already come. And with the Right to Roam movement, we pick out these particularly sensitive spaces like Lord Bennion, the Minister of Access to Nature and Biosecurity, a man who has least interest in the country in access to nature, because he would rather in his several thousand acre estate, there wasn't anybody there and he was just allowing it at high level access to paid deer stalkers and hunters. And there he is sitting on this absolutely beautiful bit of land that you can barely get to unless you follow, you know, a few short footpaths. So we have this kind of absolutely messed up way. So the whole Right to Roam movement, which is continuing, where 11th of December will be out in city squares in West London. And it's that kind of like, well, what if we did have the keys to those squares, or we were just able to go where we like? Let's just do it, and let's do it in the best possible way, en masse, with wonderful people, fancy dress, having an absolute carnival and party. Because actually, if we're doing it in a place of fear and doing it in a sense of trespass, then they're already winning, because we're not actually having the joyous experience that people need to have in nature to maintain their well-being and be healthy, connected humans. So by doing it in the way we do it, it empowers us to make sure we have a diverse and playful, and it's a very queer experience in that way, and it's very full of folly but also full of sincerity. And music in that place is very important, because we're able to bring in some songs that really help us take the time and space for contemplation about what it is. Not just going there having a rave, it has to be respectful, it has to be unimpactful on the land, but we also have to have an experience that is going to make us really love that place and actually want to protect it.
Do you ever perform the Manchester Rambler on these occasions?
Oh, I don't, for so many reasons. But
yeah, let's have those reasons. I'm fascinated.
Well, I love that song. I've grown up singing, and it's such a powerful anthem. But it's not the song that I feel speaks in the way that I want to in the moments I have to sing about actually what rambling, being in nature, is about. It's wonderful. It's a very jolly song. I will also say I've take issues with Ewan McColl on many things. Although he's a great singer and a great artist, some of his politics and behaviours and opinions I find slightly abhorrent and would not be tolerated today. So I don't want to honour him with more of a place in some of these experiences than is necessary. There's enough, enough of the white men taking leadership roles.
On that note, if anyone wants a more specific critique of some of Ewan McColl's practices, do listen to the Peggy Seeger episode we have in this archive. Please. Thinking specifically about protest song or what that means, your long experience of work with the travel community and your mentor, the late Stanley Robertson, is there anything about those musical traditions that you think speak specifically to protest?
It's a complicated one. There's so many aspects to those people that I spent time with and their situation in the world presently and historically, and in the times I was with them, the most outcasted and socially pariahed people in our country, the last forms of acceptable racism in this country is directed at the travellers. They've so much to fight about that, you know, they live in a constant state of rage and frustration and injustice, that whatever they do as an expression is, you know, an act of defiance. And when they're singing an old folk song, an old love song, that's in defiance of the fact that they are being deprived the right to live in the way they want to live. So the songs themselves might not be actively protest songs, but the fact that they are still holding on to their culture despite the government's